So you see, I didn't have to be sitting at the typewriter to work on my novel. Look, Ma, no hands. This poor old Underwood ran like a bastard for those 2 or 3 days, guard. And all the time it was running, I was in the woods, working around the place or down cellar. But as I say, mostly I was sleeping. It's funny. Even if someone could have convinced me such a gadget existed, I wouldn't have believed it would work for me, because I've always been lousy at dictating. I have to write my own letters, I always said, because I have to see the words on paper. It was impossible for me to imagine how someone could dictate a whole novel into a tape recorder, for instance, although some writers apparently do just that. But this isn't like dictating, guard. It's like a direct tap into the subconscious, more like dreaming than writing. But what comes out is unlike dreams, which are often surreal and disconnected. This really isn't a typewriter at all anymore. It's a dream machine, one that dreams rationally. There's something cosmically funny about them giving it to me so I could write the Buffalo Soldiers. You're right, it really is the best thing I've ever written, but it's still your basic oat opera. It's like inventing a perpetual motion machine so your little kid won't pester you anymore about changing the batteries in his toy car. But can you imagine what the results might have been if F. Scott Fitzgerald had had one of these gadgets? Or Hemingway? Faulkner? Salinger? After each question mark, the typewriter fell momentarily silent and then burst out with another name. After Salinger's, it stopped completely. Gardner had read the material as it came out, but in a mechanical, almost uncomprehending way. His eyes went back to the beginning of the passage. I was thinking that it was a trick, that she might have hooked the typewriter up somehow to write those two little snatches of verse, and it wrote... It had written, "No trick, guard." He thought suddenly, "Can you read my mind, Bobby?" Ding, bang, the carriage returned suddenly, making him jump and almost cry out. "Yes, but only a little."
"What did we do on the 4th of July the year I quit teaching?"
"Drove up to Derry. You said you knew a guy who'd sell us some cherry bombs. He sold us the cherry bombs, but they were all duds. You were pretty drunk. You wanted to go back and knock his block off. I couldn't talk you out of it, so we went back and damned if his house wasn't on fire. He had a lot of real stuff in the basement, and he dropped a cigarette butt into a box of it. You saw the fire and the fire trucks and got laughing so hard you fell down in the street." That feeling of unreality had never been as strong as it was now. He fought it, keeping it at arm's length while his eyes searched through the previous passage for something else. After a second or two, he found it. "There's something almost cosmically funny about them giving it to me, you know." And earlier, Bobby had said, the batteries kept falling over, and they were wild, just wild. His cheeks felt hotly flushed, as if with fever, but his forehead felt as cold as an ice pack. Even the steady pulse of pain from above his left eye seemed cold, shallow stabs hitting with metronome-like regularity. Looking at the typewriter, which was filled with that somehow ghastly green light, Gardner thought,
"Bobby, who are they?"
Ding, bang, the keys rattled off a burst, letters forming words, the words forming a child's couplet. Late last night and the night before, Tommy knockers, knocking at the door. Jim Gardner screamed. 7. At last his hands stopped shaking, enough so he could get the hot coffee to his mouth without slopping it all over himself, thus finishing the morning's lunatic festivities with a few more burns. Anderson kept watching him from the other side of the kitchen table with concerned eyes. She kept a bottle of very good brandy in the darkest depths of the pantry, far away from the alcoholic staples, and she had offered to spike Guard's coffee with a wallop of it. He had declined, not just with regret, but with real pain. He needed that brandy. It would dull the ache in his head, maybe kill it entirely. More important, it would bring his mind back into focus. It would get rid of that I-just-sailed-off-the-edge-of-the-world feeling. Only problem was he'd finally gotten to that point, hadn't he? Correct. The point where it wouldn't stop with a single wallop of brandy in his coffee. There had been entirely too much input since he had opened the hatch at the bottom of Bobby's water heater and then gone upstairs for a belt of whiskey. It had been safe then. Now the air was the unsteady sort that spawned tornadoes. So, no more drinks. Not so much as an Irish sweetener in his coffee until he understood what was happening here, including what was happening to Bobby. That, most of all. "I'm sorry that last bit happened. Anderson said. But I'm not sure I could have stopped it. I told you it was a dream machine. It's also a subconscious machine. I'm really not getting much of your thoughts at all, Guard. I've tried this with other people, and in most cases it's as easy as sinking your thumb into fresh dough. You can core all the way down to what I guess you'd call the id, although it's awful down there. Full of the most monstrous... You can't even call them ideas. Images, I guess you'd say. Simple as a child's scrawl, but they're alive. Like those fish they find down deep in the ocean, the ones that explode if you bring them up. Bobby suddenly shuddered. They're alive, she repeated. For a second there was no sound but the birds singing outside. Anyway, all I get from you is surface stuff, and most of that is all broken up and garbled. If you were like anyone else, I'd know what's been going on with you and why you look so crappy. Thanks, Bobby. I knew there was a reason I'd keep coming here, and since it's not the cooking, it must be the flattery. He grinned, but it was a nervous grin, and he lit another cigarette. As it is, Bobby went on as if he hadn't spoken, I can make some educated guesses on the basis of what's happened to you before, but you'd have to tell me the details. I couldn't snoop even if I wanted to. I'm not sure I could get it clear even if you shoved it all up to the front of your mind and put out a welcome mat. But when you asked who they were, that little rhyme about the Tommyknockers came up like a big bubble, and it ran itself off on the typewriter. All right, Gardner said, although it wasn't all right. Nothing was all right. But who are they besides the Tommyknockers? Are they pixies, leprechauns, grim? I asked you to look around because I wanted you to get an idea of how big all of this is, Anderson said. How far-reaching the implications could be. I realize that, all right, Gardner said, and a smile ghosted around the corners of his mouth. A few more far-reaching implications, and I'll be ready for a straight waistcoat. Your Tommyknockers came from space, Anderson said, as I think you must have deduced by now. Gardner supposed the thought had done more than cross his mind, but his mouth was dry, his hands frozen around the coffee cup. Are they around? He asked, and his voice seemed to come from far, far away. He was suddenly afraid to turn around, afraid he might see some gnarled thing with three eyes and a horn where its mouth should have been, come waltzing out of the pantry, something that belonged only on a movie screen, maybe in a Star Wars epic. I think they, the actual physical they, have been dead for a long time, Anderson said calmly. They probably died long before men existed on Earth. But then, Caruso's dead, but he's still singing on a hell of a lot of records, isn't he? Bobby, Gardner said, tell me what happened. I want you to begin at the beginning and end by saying, then you came up the road just in time to grab me when I passed out. Can you do that? Not entirely, she said and grinned. But I'll do my best. 8. Anderson talked for a long time. When she finished, it was past noon. Guard sat across the kitchen table, smoking, excusing himself only once to go into the bathroom, where he took 3 more aspirin. Anderson began with her stumble, told of coming back and digging out more of the ship, enough to realize she had found something utterly unique, and then going back a third time. She did not tell Gardner about Chuck the Woodchuck, who had been dead but not fly-blown, nor about Peter's shrinking cataract, nor about the visit to Etheridge the vet. She passed over those things smoothly, saying only that when she came back from her first whole day of work on the thing, she had found Peter dead on the front porch. It was as if he'd gone to sleep, Anderson said. And there was a note of schmaltz in her voice so unlike the Bobby he knew that Gardner looked up sharply, and then looked down at his hands quickly. Anderson was crying a little. After a few moments, Gardner asked, what then? Then you came up the road just in time to grab me when I passed out, Anderson said, smiling. I don't understand what you mean. Peter died on the 28th of June, Anderson said. She had never had much practice as a liar, but thought this one came out sounding smooth and natural. That's the last day I remember, clearly and sequentially. Until you showed up last night, that is. She smiled openly and guilelessly at Gardner, but this was also a lie. Her clear, sequential, unjumbled memories ended the day before, on June 27th, with her standing above that titanic thing buried in the earth, gripping the handle of the shovel. They ended with her whispering, "Everything's fine," and then beginning to dig. There was more to the tale, all right, all kinds of more, but she couldn't remember it sequentially, and what she could remember would have to be edited. Carefully edited. For instance, she couldn't really tell Gard about Peter. Not yet. They had told her she couldn't, but on that one she didn't need any telling. They had also told her Jim Gardner would have to be watched very, very closely. Not for long, of course. Soon Gard would be
part of us.
On the team. Yes, and it would be great to have him on the team, because if there was anyone in the world Anderson loved, it was Jim Gardner.
Bobby, who are they?
The Tommyknockers. That word, which had risen out of the queer opaqueness in Gard's mind like a silvery bubble, was as good a name as any, wasn't it? Sure. Better than some. So, what now? Gardner asked, lighting her last cigarette. He looked both dazed and wary.
I'm not saying I can swallow all this.
He laughed a bit wildly.
Or maybe it's just that my throat's not big enough for it all to go down at once.
I understand, Anderson said. I think the main reason I remember so little about the last week or so is that it's all so weird. It's like having your mind strapped to a rocket sled. She didn't like lying to Gard. It made her uneasy. But all the lying would be done soon enough. Gard would be... well, persuaded. When he saw the ship, when he felt the ship.
No matter how much I do or don't believe, I'm forced to believe most of it, I guess.
When you remove the impossible, whatever remains is the truth, no matter how improbable.
You got that too, did you?
The shape of it. I might not even have known what it was if I hadn't heard you say it once or twice. Gardner nodded.
Well, I guess it fits the situation we have here. If I don't believe the evidence of my senses, I have to believe I'm crazy. Although God knows there are enough people in the world who would be more than happy to testify that's just what I am.
You're not crazy, Gard. Anderson said quietly, and put her hand over his. He turned his own over and squeezed it.
Well, you know, a man who shot his wife, there are people who'd say that's pretty persuasive evidence of insanity, you know?
Gard, that was 8 years ago.
Sure. And that guy I elbowed in the tit, that was 8 days ago. I also chased a guy down Arberg's hall and across his dining room with that umbrella, did I tell you that? My behavior over the last 5 years has been increasingly self-destructive.
Hi, folks, and welcome once more to the National Self-Pity Hour, Bobby Anderson chirruped brightly. Tonight's guest is...
I was going to kill myself yesterday morning,
Gardner said quietly.
If I hadn't gotten the idea, really strong idea, that you were in trouble, I'd be fish food now.
Anderson looked at him closely. Her hand slowly tightened down on his until it was hurting. You mean that, don't you?
Christ. Sure. You want to know how bad it's gotten? It seemed like the sanest thing I could do under the circumstances.
Come off it.
I'm serious. Then this idea came, the idea you were in trouble. So I put it off long enough to call you, but you weren't here.
I was probably in the woods, Anderson said. And you came running. She lifted his hand to her mouth and kissed it gently. If this whole crazy business doesn't mean anything else, at least it means you're still alive, you asshole.
As always, I'm impressed by the almost Gallic range of your compliments, Bobby.
If you ever do it, I'll see it's written on your tombstone, Gard, asshole, in letters carved deep enough so they won't wear off for at least a century.
Well, thanks,
Gardner said.
But you won't have to worry about it for a while, because I still got it.
What?
That feeling that you're in trouble.
She tried to look away, tried to take her hand away.
Look at me, Bobby, goddammit. At last, reluctantly, she did. Her lower lip slightly pushed out in that stubborn expression he knew so well. But didn't she also look just the tiniest bit uneasy? He thought so. All of this seems so wonderful. House power from D-cells, books that write themselves, God knows what else. So why should I feel that you're in trouble?
I don't know, she said softly and got up to do the dishes. 9. Of course I worked until I damn near dropped, that's one thing, Anderson said. Her back was to him now, and he had a feeling she liked it that way fine. Dishes rattled in hot, soapy water. And I didn't just say aliens from space, ho-hum, cheap, clean, electric power and metal telepathy, big deal, you know. My mailman's cheating on his wife. I know about it. I don't want to know about it. Hell, I'm no snoop, but it was just there, guard, right there in the front of his head. Not seeing it would be like not seeing a neon sign 100 feet high. Christ, I've been rocking and reeling.
I see, he said and thought,
she's not telling the truth. At least not all of it, and I don't think she even knows it.
The question remains, what do we do now?
I don't know.
She glanced around, saw Gardner's raised eyebrows, and said, did you think I was going to give you the answer in a neat little essay, 500 words or less?
I can't. I've got some ideas, but that's all. Maybe not even very good ones.
I suppose the first thing is to take you out so you can...
be persuaded.
Have a look at it. Afterward, well...
Gardner looked at her for a long time. Bobby did not drop her eyes this time. They were open and guileless. But things were wrong here. Off note and off key. Things like that note of fake schmaltz in Bobby's voice when she spoke of Peter. Maybe the tears had been real, but that tone... it had been all wrong.
All right. Let's go take a look at your ship in the earth.
But let's have lunch first, Anderson said placidly.
You're hungry again?
Sure, aren't you?
Christ, no.
Then I'll eat for both of us, Anderson said, and she did. Chapter 10. Gardner Decides. 1.
Good God.
Gardner sat down heavily on a fresh stump. It felt like a case of sit down or fall down, like being punched hard in the stomach. No, it was stranger and more radical than that. It was more like someone had slammed the hose of an industrial vacuum cleaner into his mouth and turned it on, sucking all the wind out of his lungs in a second's time.
Good God,
he repeated in a tiny, breathless voice. It seemed to be all of which he was capable. It's something, isn't it? They were halfway down the slope, not far from where Anderson had found the dead Chuck. Before, the slope had been pretty heavily wooded. Now a lane had been cut through the trees to admit a strange vehicle, which Gardner almost recognized. It stood at the edge of Anderson's dig, and it was dwarfed both by the excavation and by the thing which was being unearthed. The trench was now 200 feet long and 20 feet wide at either end. The cut bulged to 30 feet or so in width, or perhaps 40 feet of the slit's total length. That bulge made a shape like a woman's hip seen in silhouette. The gray leading edge of the ship, its curvature now triumphantly revealed, rose out of this bulge like the edge of a giant steel tea saucer.
Good God!
Gardner gasped again.
Look at that thing.
I have been, Bobby said, a distant little smile playing over her lips. For over a week I've been looking at it. It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, and it's going to solve a lot of problems, Gard. There came a man on horseback, riding and riding.
That cut through the fog. Gardner looked around at Anderson, who might have been drifting in the dark places from which that incredible thing had come.
The look on her face chilled Gardner. Bobby's eyes were not just far off. They were vacant windows.
What do you mean?
Anderson looked around as if coming out of a deep daze.
What do you mean, a man on horseback?
I mean you, guard. I mean me.
But I think I mostly mean you.
Come on down here and take a look.
Anderson started down the slope quickly, with the casual grace of previous experience. She got maybe 20 feet before she realized Gardner wasn't with her. She looked back. He had gotten up from the stump, but that was all.
It won't bite you, Anderson said.
No. What will it do to me, Bobby?
Nothing. They're dead, guard. Your Tommyknockers were real enough, but they were mortal, and this ship has been here for at least 50 million years. The glacier broke around it. It covered it, but it couldn't move it. Not even all those tons of ice could move it, so the glacier broke around it. You can look into the cut and see it like a frozen wave. Dr. Borns from the university would go batshit over this. But they're dead enough, guard.
Have you been inside?
Gardner asked, not moving.
No.
The hatch, I think, I feel, there is one, is still buried. But that doesn't change what I know. They're dead, guard. Dead.
They're dead. You haven't been in the ship, but you're inventing like Thomas Edison on a speed trip and you can read minds, so I repeat, what's it going to do to me?
So she told the biggest lie of all. Told it calmly, with no regret at all. She said, nothing you don't want it to. And started down again, without looking back to see if he was following. Gardner hesitated, his head throbbing miserably. And then he started down after her. 2.
The vehicle by the trench was Bobby's old truck. Only before that it had been a country squire station wagon. Anderson had driven it from New York when she came to college. That had been 13 years ago, and it had not been new then. She had run it on the road until 1984, when even Elk Barker down at the Shell station, Haven's only garage and gas stop, would no longer slap an inspection sticker on it. Then, in one weekend of frenzied work, they had been drunk for most of it, and Gardner still thought it something of a miracle that they hadn't blown themselves up with Frank Garrick's old blowtorch rig. They had cut off the roof of the wagon from above the front seat on back, turning it into a half-assed truck.
"Look at that, guard, old guard,"
Bobby Anderson had proclaimed solemnly, staring at the remains of the wagon.
We done made ourselves an honest-to-God field bomber.
Then she leaned over and threw up. Gardner had picked her up and carried her onto the porch, Peter twining anxiously around his feet the whole way. By the time he got her there, she had passed out. He put her down carefully and then passed out himself. The half-assed truck had been a tough old Detroit rod bucket, but it had finally gone toes up. Anderson had put it on blocks at one end of the garden, claiming no one would want to buy it even for parts. Gardner thought she just felt sentimental. Now the truck had been resurrected, although it hardly looked like the same vehicle except for the blue paint and the remains of fake wood siding that had been one of the country squire's trademarks. The driver's door and most of the front end were gone entirely. The latter had been replaced with a weird conglomeration of digging and earth-moving equipment. To Gardner's disturbed eye, Anderson's truck now looked like a deranged child's bulldozer. Something which looked like a giant screwdriver blade protruded from the place where the grill had been. The engine looked like something which had been yanked whole from an old D9 Caterpillar.
Bobby, where did you get that engine? How did you move it from where it was then to where it is now? Good Jesus!
Yet all this, remarkable as it was, could hold his eye for only a moment or two. He walked across the ripped earth to where Bobby was standing, hands in pockets, looking into the slash in the earth. What do you think, guard? He didn't know what he thought, and was speechless anyway. The excavation went down to an amazing depth, 30 or 40 feet, he guessed. If the angle of the sun hadn't been exactly right, he wouldn't have been able to see the bottom of the trench at all. There was a space of about 3 feet between the side of the excavation and the smooth hull of the ship. That hull was utterly unbroken. There were no numbers, symbols, pictures, or hieroglyphs on it.
At the bottom of the cut, the thing disappeared into the earth. Gardner shook his head, opened his mouth, found he still had no words, and shot it again. The part of the hull Anderson had first tripped over and then tried to wriggle with her hand, thinking it might be a tin can left over from a logger's weekend, was now directly in front of Gardner's nose. He could easily have reached across the 3-foot space and grasped it, as Anderson herself had just 2 weeks ago, with this difference. When Anderson first grasped the edge of the ship in the earth, she had been on her knees. Gardner was standing. He had vaguely noted the going over the slope had taken, rough, muddy terrain, trees that had been cut and moved aside, stumps that had been pulled like rotten teeth. But beyond that momentary observation, he had dismissed it. He would have taken a closer look if Anderson had told him how much of the slope she had simply cut away. The hill had made the thing harder to get out, so she had simply removed half the hillside to make it easier.
Flying saucer,
Gardner thought faintly, and then,
I did jump. This is a death fantasy. Any second now I'll come to and find myself trying to breathe salt water. Any second now. Just any old second.
Except that nothing of the sort did or would happen, because all this was real. It was a flying saucer. And that somehow was the worst. Not a spaceship, or an alien craft, or an extraterrestrial vehicle. It was a flying saucer. They had been debunked by the Air Force, by thinking scientists, by psychologists. No self-respecting science fiction writer would put one in his story, and if he did, no self-respecting editor would touch it with a 10-foot pole. Flying saucers had gone out of vogue in the genre at roughly the same time as Edgar Rice Burroughs and Otis Adelbert Klein. It was the oldest wheeze in the book. Flying saucers were more than passé. The idea itself was a joke, given mental house room these days only by crackpots, religious eccentrics, and, of course, the tabloid newspapers, where any week's budget of news had to include at least one saucer story, such as 6-year-old pregnant by saucer alien, tearful mother reveals. These stories, for some odd reason, all seemed to originate in either Brazil or New Hampshire. And yet here was such a thing. It had been here all the while, as centuries passed above it like minutes. A line from Genesis suddenly occurred to him, making him shiver as if a cold wind had blown past.
There were giants in the earth in those days.
He turned toward Anderson, his eyes almost pleading.
Is it real?
He could no more than whisper. It's real. Touch it. She knocked on it, producing that dull fist-on-mahogany sound again. Gardner reached out, then pulled his hand back. A look of annoyance passed over Anderson's face like a shadow. I told you, Gard, it won't bite you.
It won't do anything to me. I don't want it to.
Absolutely not. Gardner reflected, as much as he was able to reflect in his current state of roaring confusion, that he had once believed that about booze. Come to think of it, he had heard people, most of them his college students in the early 70s, say the same thing about various drugs. Many of them had ended up in clinics or drug counseling sessions with severe nose candy problems.
Tell me, Bobby, did you want to work until you dropped? Did you want to lose so much weight that you looked like an anorexic? I guess all I really want to know is, did you drive or was you driven? Why did you lie about Peter? Why don't I hear birds in these woods?
Go on, Anderson said patiently. We've got some talking to do and some hard decisions to make, and I don't want you breaking in halfway through to say you've decided the whole thing was just a hallucination that came out of a liquor bottle.
That's a shitty thing to say.
So are most of the things people really have to say. You've had the DTs before, you know it, and so do I.
Yeah, but the old Bobby never would have brought it up. Or at least, not in that way.